views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. It's your host, Dr. James Kelly. To those checking this out for the very first time, I say thank you so much. Today on the show, I have the honor of interviewing Mr. Jeffrey Hazlett. Jeffrey Hazlett is the founder, CEO of the C-Suite Network. Also had the number one business show on Bloomberg called C-Suite. Also was a three-time New York Times bestseller for three of his books. And CMO, as well as bought and sold over 250 companies, roughly $25 billion. So we had an awesome conversation talking about what it was like being raised in a military house, having to fend for himself, basically, to buy his food and clothes at about 15, 16 years old. And just his ethos. I mean, he really is just a good old South Dakotan, I guess you would say, and who loves to hunt. Loves the simple life, and is just really down to earth. So I had a great conversation with him. Also, I want to say thank you to my content partners, C-Suite Radio, as well as Transformation Radio. I'm on their Business Conscious Network. And for this episode, Engage Me, which is an online magazine focused on employee engagement. I also want to let you know that I have a new website coming out. It is the three dubs. Dr. James Kelly, KELLEY.com. Check it out. All the podcasts will be there, as well as the ability to book me for any speaking engagements you want. All right. Have a nice week, everybody. Hopefully it was the best one. I'm hoping that was it.
Yeah, they all aren't. They are. Yeah. They all are.
No, I have some shit ones. Don't get me wrong. Like, I have some bad ones. I had one time
where I got through with the interview. The guy, I said, I'm not using this. The guy goes, what are you talking about? I said, dude, you should know media better than this. This is the worst interview I've ever had. And, you know, you answering yes, no, and being a total ass doesn't help.
Yeah, right.
And I told the guy that.
Like when you have to pull teeth to get further than yes, it's a bit of an effort. I had a guy come on, and you know, that whole stick of my podcast is really autobiographical, like who are you as a person, not so much what you do. And the guy comes on, and like 10 minutes in, I realize his whole name is a pseudonym. Like, it's his book name, his author name, but it's not really him. And I was like, what the hell are you doing on my podcast? Like, I told you this is autobiographical, and I can't ask you about your family because you don't have a real person. Like, is this all? I was so annoyed.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, it was one of those where, again, I asked him, I was getting desperate, and I go, what makes you laugh? And he goes, when other people make mistakes on things that have happened in the past. And I said, you're kind of an ass. I was like, what does that mean?
Yeah. I had another guy I told one time, I said, listen, if you were here, I'd punch you in the throat. And I said this on air, and I kept it in there. Because the guy was just total. I mean, what he said and how he said it, is a guy who wrote. He's the guy that was in Goldman Sachs Elsevier, overheard in Goldman Sachs Elsevier, and he's a trader. And he referred to women as goats, as in like the bait, like for Jurassic Park, yeah, for the dinosaurs. And I said, dude, you have a daughter, right? He goes, yeah. I go, don't you have any remorse in saying that? Well, you don't understand. It's the industry. No. You're in. The industry is the people that make up the freaking industry. And you're saying that you're okay with your daughter being bait for other guys. Well, not my daughter. Well, wait, yeah. My daughter's better. It's okay. It's my daughter and not your daughter. I said, dude, if you were right here, I'd punch you in the throat right now. You disgust me. You disgust me. And people like you. And I was like, yeah. Well, anyway,
that's just like the whole the whole culture permeates that. You know, in that it's such bullshit. A male dominated culture and industry in of itself.
Yeah.
It's mind blowing to me. And I know you have a history with Donald Trump. So I, by all means, will stay off that topic. But it's
No, you can know. Go ahead. I don't care.
All right. Well, you know, I don't want to offend anyone. So I'm.
You're not going to. How can you be offended? Let's have a discussion about that. I think he's batshit crazy, but he's still my friend. Okay. and so you can, why can't you have a conversation about that? So when did it become in this country that we'd be a no tolerance for anything?
So I think that's valid.
One side or the other.
But I think the point is that, you know, for me, it reflects me as a person. If I'm attacking, not attacking, I don't know if that's the right word. I don't think I would attack, but I don't want to offend you as a person. So I tend to err on the side of like, what might you be thinking? All right. Will this tick you off?
Well, can you, aside from calling me a Nazi or and showing people that I am, why can't we have a debate about that? Why can't we have that's what this country was founded on, man.
But I guess we,
I'm so passionate about like, you have every right to burn the American flag. I think you're an asshole for doing it, but you have every right for doing that, and I will defend your right to do that. Now, it disgusts me. I can't stand it. I'm one of those guys that I'd like to put the American flag on a patch on my shoulder, but my dad told me when he came back from Vietnam War that I didn't earn it.
Yeah,
and it's a uniform, and he made me learn the guidelines for how to display a flag properly. To this day, I now run up to lecterns and podiums and fix it. So
I guess I agree with you. You know, and I think that your point is true. Like, we should be able to have the conversation. I guess what I always go down to is why are we so quick to explode when someone doesn't agree with us?
So what if they don't agree with us? That makes for better copy. So nothing wrong with that.
But like, but we explode so fast, right?
I don't care. Anyway, I don't care. I don't care. We do that. And, you know, it's like all this intolerance on Facebook of someone's opinion. You know, look, just respect my right to have a different opinion. Don't call me names. Don't be hurtful. And don't limit my own rights as a human being and as a citizen of this country. And I'll be glad to do whatever. But the second you do that, I'm going to hit you in the face with a baseball bat. But, you know, or call you a troll or whatever. But, you know, I don't have a problem with that because I have friends who are total opposites. I mean, who are so far to the left that hate him and so far to the right that they have statues of him, you know. And I'm okay.
But this leads me to my first actual question. Like, you clearly have this moral compass. Was it delivered by your dad? Because you were a military kid.
Are we alive on air now?
Yeah, we're going. Okay. I just start talking.
Oh, good. I love this. It's by all those people. I don't think it's by one person or another. Certainly did my dad influence me on some things, but my mother influenced me on others. My grandmother influenced me on things. Mr. Pinson, who I grew up to know and, lived down the road, who was kind of one of my mentors at one time, a plumber. He did that. Harold Jones, who, you know, was a Marine gunner and a helicopter who kind of adopted me when my dad was overseas, you know, and was my baseball coach, did more. I mean, I think it's a process of socialization. And so therefore, I think lots of things make up that and the way in which you're brought up and you're socialized. And that gives you your moral compass. So I don't think it's just, it could be for some people, it could certainly be one thing or another. But for me, it was lots of things.
So it sounds like you were just kind of backing up a little bit. You know, you grew up in this family with a military father. You moved a ton. How many times do you think you moved growing up?
12, probably, at least.
So my wife is a military brat as well, right? She moved a ton. Yeah. And so one of the things that I think is an outcome of someone moving a lot as a military child is, one, you basically can become a chameleon in any situation. Right. You can walk in and figure out, how do I socialize? Who are the key players?
It's called survival. Cause you know, every,
totally.
Yeah, cause I had a younger brother and younger sister at the time. And of course my dad remarried and I've got two kids that are the same age as my kids, but they, my two younger brothers, but yeah, you do that because as you get to a new school, I mean, I can tell you the first time I got to a new school, okay, it's fight time, you know, because that's what you did when you got to these kinds of schools. They, you know, somebody grab your hat and make fun of you and then pick on your brother. And now I gotta beat the kid up to, you know, show them a tough kid so they leave us alone. And, you know, and yeah. Or you just get beat up and that's when you're going to take it and that's what you're going to be. So, you know, it's those kinds of things that were back then. Now I don't think they're that way now, other than the fact they're still mean kids and still cliques and all that other stuff. I still think go on. But yeah, I do think every person that I know that I went to school with, and by the way, I used to see those people at various schools at different Air Force bases around the world. So, you know, Zychek, a gal that I grew up with, I knew her in junior high at one place, and then I met her in high school later on. Sue Zychek is her name, by the way. And you know, so yeah, those people, I tend to think that we're a little, I don't want to say we're more well-rounded, but we certainly have a lot more exposure to the more worldly things or things in life that make us just get over it. And to get to another point, you know, I'm sure that maybe when you first met your wife, you said, well, geez, that was kind of weird. That's not healthy that you've lived in all these places. And people say that to me all the time. Well, that's really weird. Well, no, weird's going to the same school, living in the same city all your freaking life.
No,
really knowing the same.
But what I would say to that, what I would say to that, though, so I did grow up in one house. I was 17. Now, from 17 to now 42, I've lived in four major U.S. cities in three countries.
That's cool. Good for you.
So my wife, so quick to adapt, right? Here's the downside, and I see this with her brothers, except for two of her brothers went to the military academy. Two, and then the other three went to Notre Dame. So clearly a stupid family all the way around. She particularly is awful at keeping friends. So she's great to make them. If we move, they're in the old place. Let's move on.
Well, that's just because she's shallow and trite. But no, I'm just teasing. No, you know, I will tell you, I'm the same way. I have lots of friends and lots of friends. How many really deep friends? Well, enough to carry my casket when I'm dead, right? So, and that's how I measure real friends. Is who's going
to... So your two kids and your wife?
No. My wife is my best friend, so without question. Yeah. I would want to spend more time with her. You know, first of all, I'm married to me. I wouldn't... I know me and I wouldn't be married to me. So I'm very, very faithful. So that's one. And then two, she is my best friend because we just enjoy doing everything together. And because she laughs at my jokes and she thinks I'm funny and she thinks I'm good looking and all these other things that many other people don't. So... But when I talk about real friends, I'm talking about these are the people I want to carry a gun with because I'm a big hunter. These are the share similar values. They're just they're my dear friends. I mean, and I could say that these are men and a few women, but mostly men that I love. I love dearly and I would do anything for. And, you know, that, and I don't have a lot of those, but I do have a few of them. And those are my real friends. But I have friends, I mean, literally around the world, tens and tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands of friends, you know, by Twitter and everything else. But people I would really call friends, I have a lot of them.
Well, and I think as men, our tendency is to have more in-depth friendships and not many of those than to have 30 friends that we're close with but not deep with. I think it's... And depending on the men, I always find that men from Europe are much better about talking about their emotions and feelings than men from the U.S., for example, just in general, generality. But, you know, I only have a handful of really close guy friends, but I've got friends all over the world. So not to your scale, don't get me wrong. But the point is that, you know, my Mary, if we like, we move from Philadelphia, you know, I live in the Middle East now. I don't know if you know that or not, but I live outside Dubai. Mm. And my wife, you know, we moved from Philadelphia. She's talked to like those, we lived there 7 years. She's talked to those friends three times. Mm-hmm. One of them that she was really, that's it for her. It's just like, all right, new place, new situation. So I find it fascinating. So when you're growing up though, yeah, in this house, this military house.
I'm kind of like that. I would tend to think that's the case. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think that's an impact, it's an outcome of a military household.
Yeah, and see, right? and some people say that, some people would say that's healthy or not healthy. I bet you can ask her this question, because I don't think healthy is the right word, but to us, that's normal.
I think it is.
To us, it's normal. It's normal. It just is. It's normal.
Yeah.
It's just normal. So whether it's, you know, one's better over the other, I don't know. Who knows that?
Were you ever in Dayton, Ohio?
Yeah, sure. My brother and sister were born in Wright-Patterson. Yeah.
So I have to wonder if your dad was in the Air Force same time as my father-in-law, because he's Air Force, right, Pat? They were there for like 10 years.
Yeah, we would have been there in like 61 through about 64.
Nope, yeah, never mind. Yeah. this would have been the 70s, yeah, 80s. 70s, it's a different time
70s, late 60s, early 70s, he was in. But we were stationed all over the place. And we were Wright-Patterson only once. And my brother and sister were born there. So that would have been like 61, 62, 63. So, but yeah.
So with a dad in the military, were your parents married for basically the better part of your childhood?
Yeah. Up through 14. You know, you got to remember that there was a time period in the United States, you know, let's say at, you know, mid 70s, where it was really tough. And, you know, if you've deployed for, you know, 3 or 4 years overseas, you're away from your family, you're in wartime, it's difficult. You know, we now know a lot more about it. And so when my parents, you know, in, you know, 12, 13, 14, yeah, that's when they split up. And so, you know, for that point of my life up to adulthood, yeah, we were together, in great times. And then my parents split. And then my later teens, I went to live with my father because he relocated to South Dakota. My mother remarried to another guy who I didn't get along with, you know, because that, you know, got to remember at 14, 15, 16 years old.
Yeah.
I'm a handful in itself, like most young.
And you're an oldest.
And I'm the oldest.
Right? So you felt like you were kind of the.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you felt like you were probably the man of the house because your dad was gone a lot already.
Yeah, sure. Which was the case, you know, because when I was 12, 13 years old, I had full-time jobs, you know, and I was earning and I was giving my paycheck to my mom. So, yeah, I felt like that. So and I was working for Mr. Pinson, as I mentioned before. I was a plumber's assistant back then. And so doing every other odd job I could get my hands on just to make money. But exactly. So I moved away. I thought, well, she's married. She's taken care of now. She's worrying about my brother and sister more than me. And I'll just go live with my dad because he was going back to South Dakota. And South Dakota was the dream place for me. You know, it was the Black Hills of the western part of the state. It was hunting. It was fishing. It was wild.
What about
everything?
Was it that?
Yeah, spiritual. It's a very spiritual place. It was the greatest time of my life, and it still is. I still live in South Dakota. Even though I've traveled the rest of the world in my career, I've always come back and relocated back to South Dakota. Our main home is in South Dakota. Met my wife, who's from South Dakota. We chose to live here with me traveling all over the world so that my children can grow up in this state. And
is it Bismarck?
Or no, that's North part? Dakota. That's North Dakota. The South Dakota.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, Sioux Falls, Rapid City, Pierre. Cities. You know, there's only 700,000 people in the whole state of South Dakota, so it's not a massive population base, but it's certainly a big state. You know, we're about 250 miles tall by 450 miles wide. And
well, I've driven through it a couple times.
It's not for everyone because it's a prairie state, so it's flat and not as flat as Kansas, but flat and, you know, a lot of grass, not many trees. You know, today it's below zero. You know, in the summertime it's above 100. But, you know, to me it's an extremely spiritual place for me. And I think each of us have our own areas where we go, and that's kind of our center. And this is a centering place for me.
So let me tell you my experience with South Dakota. I was traveling from San Jose. I lost my job during the dot-com bust. And I decided to get my MBA. And so I was traveling from San Jose up through Portland, up through Glacier, traveling back through South Dakota, heading over to New York. And I was with my friend. Now, picture a guy wearing board shorts, tank top, a beard, bleach blonde hair just past his ears during Sturgis. And I walked in, my friend and I, we walked in. He was also a bit like that as well. We walked into a bar, dirt floor, straight saloon style doors. And I swear to God, you could hear the record just screech to a halt when these two like surf dudes walk in to have a beer and a bite to eat. And we just look at each other. We really just thought this is the Where's Waldo moment. Yeah. Because we just did not belong there during Sturgis whatsoever.
Well, you got to be clear.
Man,
you have to be clear that during Sturgis, everyone from South Dakota leaves the state. So we you know, it's not a place you go. It's a place where it's a place literally where 500,000 to 750,000 people show up for a week in a small town that's normally, I think, or just maybe got, I don't know, 7,000, maybe 10,000 people. It might be bigger than that. And you know, I would never be caught dead there. There are a few people that from South Dakota that go, but I just wouldn't be caught dead there. You just don't want to go.
So I found it fascinating. Yeah. And it was amazing to me to see the amount of people, you know, going there. So as you're growing up, though, in South Dakota, and clearly it has this hold on you as an individual. When you started living with your dad again, though, like, was that a stressful time period for you? Was he this hard military dad?
Yeah.
I just picked, my dad was a Vietnam guy too. And I was going to ask you this question as well, actually. So did your dad have any like post traumatic stress syndrome?
You know,
from Vietnam?
Yeah. Well, he did. I didn't know it at the time. That's what it was. You know, first of all, my dad was kind of a real hard ass anyway. He was a sergeant. You know, he was one of those gruff and rough and, you know, great looking, good looking guy, well respected, you know, total yes sir, no sir manners, you know, coming out of every pore of his body. You know, like, you know, God forbid, I called one of his friends one time, Charlie Longino, who was also a sergeant. I said something. I said, you know, Charlie. And he backhanded me. So, and he goes, that's, you know, he backhanded me across the room and said, that's Mr. Longino to you. And, you know, I don't forget things like that.
Yeah.
And that's the way it was. And so anyone that was older than me was Mr. or Mrs. And I, to this day, I say yes. No,
totally
sir.
The same.
And I say that to young people as well as older people, less so with the younger people, but I still say yes, ma'am, no, ma'am.
Yeah.
And I just find myself doing that more and more, or even when I see a group of young guys, I'll just say gentlemen, you know, or something like that, you know. Yeah. I'm a little bit more formal, but yeah, he had that. He was a hard ass. Dad ended up getting Agent Orange. He was a B-52 mechanic. Of course, they were around that stuff all the time. And so he passed in 2001 at 61 years old because of Agent Orange and the cancer that he developed as a result of it, lost a lung and a couple of other things. But that's clearly what it was. Yeah, probably didn't help that he smoked 2 packs of cigarettes a day, too. But, you know.
Yeah, I don't know lucky, if that was helping the situation.
Yeah, lucky strikes. He used to smoke lucky strikes. But, yeah, it was hard, to be honest with you. It wasn't easy. You know, I will just give you the story. I don't always tell the story, but since we're in more personal stuff, you know, I remember that he paid my mother for each of the children $63 a month in child support. Now, the reason I know that, because when I went to live with him when I was 15 turning 16, he gave me $63 a month. And that's what I had to buy food with school and buy clothing with. And it was my responsibility to get my clothes and my responsibility to get my food. And if I needed more than that, then I had to go get a job, of which I did. And so I worked every day, you know, after school I was a janitor at a department store. That was a big job for many years, in a stock. And then I sold, so it was a clerk and all that stuff as well. But I was the primary job was a janitor. I cleaned the toilets. I was real good at it too. And, to the point where today I like a clean bathroom, which I've written about in my books, but that's what it was. Now, would you think is that a hard ass?
Yeah.
You know, was that difficult? Yeah, that's not, no kid should have to do that. And I look back on now knowing, you son of a bitch, you shouldn't have been so mean, but did I learn something from it? Yeah. Did I die as a result of it? No.
But I always think, my dad, he was in Vietnam. I think he only did one tour, but it was also a hindsight about having, traumatic stress syndrome as well. I remember going to the mall one time at Christmas and he just was flying through the mall. My dad was 5'11", 280, and he baled hay in the summer as a kid. So he had Popeye arms. He had quads and hamstrings the size of the moon in my mind. They probably were tiny, but in my head, they were huge. And I remember going through the mall and he elbowed a little kid in the forehead by accident, but he didn't even stop. Like didn't even
know.
Miss a beat because because he was so panicked in that crowd that he had to get out to the open.
Yeah.
And at the time, I was like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And then, but as an adult, I could see it now. I'm like, he had that. He had PTSD. Like, it was very clear. And that's why he hated the mall, hated grocery shopping, hated any of that stuff when there was crowds. And I also remember my dad was highly disciplined about yes or no, sir. And I have this story. So I was the youngest of three, and my two older brothers, my dad was a saint. He married my mom and she had two kids, and one was 5 and 3. And then they had me, and I was 5 years younger than my middle brother. But I remember we had that battle of yes or no, sir. And I was like 13, 14. And when you're that age, you're a little bit like, I don't want the authority rule. And we were sitting there and he goes, I forget what I did, but he goes, yes. Yes, what? And I said, yes. And he goes, yes, what? And I'm like, yes.
Yes, sir.
Yes, yeah. What?
I know exactly what that is.
And I knew what he wanted. Yeah. And he was just like, and he was back like 5 minutes. And I was just like, yes. He's like, get out of my room. And I'm like, I won. I broke my dad, It was my proudest moment, I think. I think I broke him mentally as well. Like, spiritually, I think he realized he lost me at that point.
I can remember the time, too. My dad, I was 16. It was in the summer when I was 16. And my dad was a very physically abusive as well. Meaning we would get beat. Now, I was the older of the kids. So when we were younger, I took the brunt of that, which I knew I did. Knew that growing up. I actually realized it more later in life and my brother and sister have only come to the realization of some of that at this later age in our 50s of the things that I had to endure or do because of I was the oldest, and they didn't. And so, of course, you can get the whole thing about the guilt of you thought you deserved it and all that other stuff, or that was your duty, bullshit. No, it was like, I was a kid, you son of a bitch, But I remember when I was 16 and that moment with my dad was I was used to be petrified of my dad when you would ask for a tool. And I remember one time I was 10 years old and he asked me for this one tool. I didn't know which tool it was. And I was afraid not to bring it back. So I brought the entire toolbox with me, and which was very heavy, and I had to carry it between my legs, and I had to carry it. We lived in a mobile home. I had to carry it all the way from one side all the way around to the other. And he goes, "Why the hell did you bring this damn toolbox?" I said, "Because you asked for the tool." He goes, "I asked you for that tool." I said, "Yes, sir. I did not understand you. So I brought all of the tools." And he just acknowledged it, and he says, "This one, learn it." Boom. And I remember when I was 16. He asked me for this tool. He asked me to help him fix it was an alternator in his 1970 Ford Bronco. And we were replacing the alternator. The thing had a bad alternator all the time. And so we were replacing the alternator and he asked me, by that time I was just about bigger than him. Okay. I'm 6'3", 270 pounds today. So I'm much bigger than what he would have been now, but I didn't gain my size until my senior year. I was over 200 pounds my senior year, and then I gained a lot more in my first year, second year of college. I got to the size I am today. But you know, even back then, I was high school All-American, high school All-State, and all that stuff. But I remember helping him with the alternator, and he asked me to help him tighten this thing, and I wasn't tightening it the way. And he goes, and he said something like, "You weak little bastard!" And he reached back to hit me with a hammer, and he was going to hit me with it. And I remember turned to him, and I grabbed something, and I said, "Take your best shot because I'm going to kick your ass." And I said that to him, and he looked at me and he put the thing down and went right back to work. And that was it. That was the last time. That was the last time that we ever had a conversation like that. And
it switched. Yeah, it flipped. It made the flip.
He knew then I was serious. I was going to pop him. And that was the end of it. I was not taking this, you know, anymore. And I think there's always that when, even, you know, my own son, who I never treated that way, there's always that moment when you're now the adult, you know, and it comes in different forms. For some people, it comes a much more civilized way and a much more, I would say, healthier way. And then for others, it comes through a little bit more of a struggle, but nonetheless, they come, right?
Can I just say that our lives, at least at this, you know, 29 minutes in, parallel fairly similar. So like, I remember growing up having to fix in the middle of winter, hold the light under the car to fix the transmission and put it in, and getting yelled at if I didn't hold the light right, getting smacked. Mm-hmm. And I remember the moment too. Yeah, I was a bit younger, but I was 13, and I don't know the situation, but he slapped me, and I just said, "If you hit me again," and I remember this so vividly. I'm like, "I'm fucking leaving this house." And I never swore. Obviously, yeah. You're 13. Why would you swear to your dad? But that's where it was at. And he hit me, and I walked out of the house, and I'm going up the street, and all I hear my mom say is, "Go get him." And I get up top of the street. He's driving this car, opens the window. He's like, "Get in." And I'm screaming, "Are you going to hit me again?" And I basically just embarrassed him in front of the whole neighborhood. He was like, "Are you going to hit me again?" And he said, "No." And he literally never hit me again until I was about 20. And I said to my mom, "You're being a bitch." And then he backhanded me.
Well,
and
yeah.
I thought, I probably deserve
You deserve that.
Yeah.
Quite frankly.
Totally. Yeah. I totally was like, I didn't even get mad about it. I was like, I probably deserve that.
I want to hit you just because you said that to your mom.
Totally. Yeah. Like, I got it. I was like, yeah. All right. That was the last time he hit me. You know, and I was like, fair enough. But it's such a fascinating thing because psychologically, something inside you says, "I can't take this anymore.
Right.
I deserve more respect as a human being."
Right. Yeah. Yeah. She, you know, the same. So, well, I can remember another time when I was about 11, we were fishing in the Black Hills in what was called Rapid Creek, a great trout stream. And my dad was using this lure on this little pool, and it was a red devil. It was right next to this dirt road where we were at. And it was a red devil lure, which, if you know a red devil lure, it's like 79 cents, maybe $1.20. Okay. Back then it was probably like 29 cents, you know, and he got it caught on a stick underneath the water, you know, and it hung up and there was the lure and you could see it through the crystal water. You could see that lure down in the water. Okay. So this is about April in the Black Hills of South Dakota, maybe May, but April, probably April. So there's still snow on the ground. And he says to me, and I'm with my younger brother, Bill, "Jeff, take your clothes off in there and jump in that water and get that lure." Now there's that water's cold. And I'm butt naked. And I strip down naked, butt naked, jump in the water, but I'm pretending like I can't see that lure. Cause I'm pissed. Cause I'm not getting it. And I can still to this day see the image of the fuzzy lure in the water in front of me. And every time I kept coming up for water, he goes, "Just reach out and get it." And I said, "I can't see it. I can't see it. I can't see it." Thinking, asshole, there's no way. And of course, then right then I'm naked. Somebody drives by in a pickup truck. Of course they can, you know, I'm 11 years old. The last thing anyone to do is see you naked, right? Yeah. I remember I got out of that water. It was cold as ice. And I thought, get your own lure.
You know what's funny is like stuff like that. I mean, obviously not to the same degree. I hope your kids probably have done the same thing to you.
Oh, without question.
You know,
and quite frankly, to some extent, rightfully so. You know, but at least I can say to my children, I can say to my children, you didn't have it the way I had it. Not that I'm proud of that, but I'm proud that I tell my children, there are things that you don't like about how I treated you or the way you grew up. Got it. I get it. I understand it. I own that. But it wasn't as bad as that. And you know what? You're now empowered to change it for your kids and the next generation.
Yeah.
And hopefully each generation we can have these breakthroughs to be that much better, because we're either enlightened by that or we choose not to live that way. I just don't want you to be disappointed that I didn't try, you know, and I think that, I think that's important.
Well, I also think that I could be bitter. I mean, my dad passed away when I was 20. And I could be bitter about all sorts of shit growing up, but I really came to the conclusion pretty early on. Part of it was forced therapy for a stupid mistake I made in my early 20s. I got a DUI in my company car, and the outcome of that is that I had to go to, by the state, mandatory rehab sessions 3 days a week for 3 hours a night for 6 months. And then once a month for 3 hours, and then a year of therapy, like to see a counselor. But, you know, what I came to the conclusion of is that as parents, and especially now that I have four kids, like, you just do the best you can with what you have. Yeah. And there's no manuals. Yep. And I've already conceded that I will screw my kids up to some degree. And I hope that I minimize their therapy to at least under a year. Like, that's all I'm asking for. Like, you know, you just do the best. And I say that tongue in cheek about the therapy, but like, you just do your best and to do better than your parents did. And I think that's what it comes down to as a parent.
Yep. And if you can.
And Mary Wright.
Yeah.
Mary Wright. That's my name. Mary the right woman.
Yeah. Or man or guy or whatever it is you want.
Whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whatever trips your trigger. I think that's an important distinction, and I think one that well noted. And by the way, if you need help, go get help. That's the thing.
Nothing
wrong with that.
Nothing wrong. So do you still get along with your siblings? Do you still talk to them?
Oh yeah. Oh, very good. We're all very close. Yeah, to different degrees. That's awesome. We're all different degrees. You know. Yeah. We all get along better. Quite frankly, I don't know. I would say this. I think as children, we all get along with one, brother or sister better than the other. With different ones, we have different roles. You know, with my younger brothers, I'm taking on more of a father role because they, that's just because of my age and just my life and everything. And so, we're the close like that. So it's just, it's different for different ones, And by the way, my father lived till he was 61. And now so he had children again. He had children the same age as my kids again, but he realized he made mistakes. And, he said some things to me. We never really had those conversations because my dad and I never have that kind of deep conversation like that. But it was acknowledged. And he treated his other boys different than he treated us. Although he still had some issues with it. I mean, and there were times when he and I would talk like, Dad, don't do that. When he would, reach back to hit one of the boys and I would happen to be there. I said, Dad, don't do that. That's not right. So I would speak up about those kind of things, but he was better. He was a lot better.
I think probably perspective, right? So there's a big gap between you
and I had a conversation with one of my younger brothers lives right next door to me and he's a pastor and he and I have had that, you had it different and they know that too. Mm-hmm. They know that too. So
just to kind of move, this is obviously the podcast. It's really super organic, so you're aware. But just to kind of move forward a little bit, I'm curious about, I had Connie Fife on my show.
Yeah, Connie, I love
last
Connie.
Week.
She's on our C-Suite Radio Network, and then also she's thinking about doing one of our TV show for us too.
Yeah, and so she also has kind of a similar story to you in terms of just a super hard upbringing. And I'm always curious, why do you think you broke out? Because you could have easily gone down a completely different path.
Mm. Why would it be different? I don't know.
What about you? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you could have just worked and gone to a Burger King your whole life, which is fine. Totally honorable work. not shitting on that, but you took a totally different path.
I would have no problem if I worked at a Burger King. I just happened to get these other things. You know, I don't.
But what about you? Like, what drove you to do that?
I wanted some of those things. You know, I liked it. And I saw that it's hard work, but everything's hard work. But if it's hard work and you get this, that's different than that hard work. Okay, I want this.
But were you driven to get out of that situation? Like, were you driven to break a cycle?
I think that, well, yes, of some kind of cycle. But what that was, I don't know. Like, I realized it then, nor I know what that would be today. Other than I just wanted to do more than what I was doing. And I got that piece of the drive, I think I got from my mother more than my father. Because I look back on my mother and father's life, she was very successful at doing everything in business. Although she was, you know, she didn't have a college education, nor did he, but she wasn't as worldly as he was because he traveled all over the world. But my mother was a bookkeeper, and then she became a real estate agent. When she became a real estate agent, then she became like a little mogul. But yet she was a very traditional housewife and remarried. She actually remarried three times, and her third husband, who is just a wonderful guy, she took on that role, but she's clearly wore the pants in the family with that, you know, still does or did. Mm-hmm. She passed a few years ago as well from leukemia, but I'm still very close to my stepfather, who I never knew until after, you know, he and my mother, remarried when I was my high school year. So I didn't even go to their wedding, to be honest with you. Because I was too busy working. I was too busy working. I had a good job. I was going to have to eat, you know.
Yeah. Were you like, after your mom, because my mom is in her 70s and not the healthiest individual I've ever seen. You know, having lost my father when I was young, like, was there a sense of, I don't know if orphanism is the right word, but after your mom passed away, like, I don't know. Like, was there kind of a sense of loneliness of family at that point?
No, I think about my mother, my father all the time. My grandmother lived; she was 105. She passed before my mother did. My son just had his second child, and he named his daughter, second child, after used my mother's middle name as the baby's middle name. When I heard that, I cried, you know, cause that was very special. And then awesome. Of course, when I was home, I just got home yesterday and I went and saw the baby for the first time cause it's only 3 days old, and they said to you, did you like that? And of course I liked it. How could you not? You know, yeah. What an honor to her, you know? You see in your children the things in your mother. You see in your children the things of your father. You see in your children the things of your brother or of your wife or of you. So I think all those things are pretty special for all of us, you know? So, yeah, there's always that sense. But that's life. I mean, that's life. Do you miss things? Yeah. Yeah. Do you want things? Yeah. Do you complacent with certain things? Yeah. So all those things, that's just life.
So I'm always just curious about that because, I feel like I'm pretty close to my mom, even though I live in a totally different country. But what that's going to be like when she passes. Just to transition here slightly, I'm actually curious about your trajectory into the business world because, you know, you ascend to CMO of Kodak and, you know, Eastman Kodak, but there's obviously a story before that. And luckily Wikipedia is fantastic because it gives me that story, but it doesn't give me the story before that. So like, what did you do before Eastman Kodak?
Well, right before that, I had a public relations firm with three people in it. That was it. So, prior to that, I helped him. I bought, but it was a small company, but it was very profitable what we did, but it was PR and business development. And I helped buy and sell companies. I bought and sold over 250 companies in my career, about $25 billion in transactions. I've owned started a franchise. You know, I've owned independent businesses. I sit on 14 boards today, corporate boards of various sizes and companies, public and private. And, you know, with all those things, we just, you know, there was lots of things I did to get up to that point. You know, I headed up sales and marketing for a couple billion dollar company prior to the time at Kodak. Before that, you know, the PR company before that and after that. And then I helped buy and sell a lot of companies to Kodak and to other companies for billions of dollars. So just lots of different things. Mostly you've been in marketing or PR. Through most of my career, you know, either running political campaigns or, you know, saving medical schools from closing, you know, to you know, campaigns to ballot issues to selling boxes of soap, you know, for that matter.
So you have just a randomness.
Yeah, well, it's like, always about.
I don't mean random in the sense. Sorry, yeah. That's what I was gonna say. I don't mean random in like there was like everything led to something else. That's what I mean by random.
No, I have the ability to take small things and make them big quickly. What I call high growth. That's the kind of my specialty. I like lots of startups and I'm very strategic and seeing many moves across the chessboard quickly and have been in many situations where because of my frequency of doing those things and the number of doing those that has allowed me to have a depth that most people don't have. So that when I can walk into a room, in essence, you can smell it and see it before it happens, you know, and so there's a sense of that that others don't have. You know, like people say, well, you don't understand our situation. It's different. No, it's not. No, it's not. You know, let's be clear. It's not. OK, it's a box of soap. It's a cure for disease. It's a put up candidate. It's all in the packaging, dude. So let's just put it together. So, you know,
but you just said this. You said this sentence of like you can walk into a room and kind of see it and smell it. Like, what does that look like to you?
It's a very visual, like instant, almost like a mind meld instant kind of thing where it's just boom, it's there. You know, that I have a sense of I've been here before. And so it's a comfort level of knowing that there's not much they're going to pitch to me. I mean, look, I've been involved with, you know, employees who have gone into plants and shot people and then set the place on fire. I've been in those, you know, and I've had to come out of that. I've had, you know, about every kind of takeover, hostile takeovers. I've had close to bankruptcies. I've had to, you know, make the cold calls myself. I've, you know, had to learn Salesforce. I've had to, you know, do this and do that. I used to write copy for, you know, credit card companies, you know, to sell you.
So nothing shocks you at this point.
Well, I don't know if that it's a different kind of shock. You just understand that you're going to. You're always going to be amazed. You're always going to be shocked. You're always going to be bored. You're always going to be so there. Yeah. Just I don't let those things throw me off center. That's a better way of describing it. Meaning I'm very grounded you said early on moral compass, but I'm very grounded. And as a result of being extremely grounded, now I do go off the don't get me wrong, I do go off the edge many times, but it's usually in a way of going for something better, and a zeal that brings to that that's an intensity level that most people don't normally have. So, and I have an understanding of that. I have an understanding of that, and I came to that very quickly. Even just like you know, we're talking about physical size. That I'm intimidating that way. And it just comes and I don't try to question it. I just try to use it. And I think but you also get underestimated. Yeah. When you're a big guy like me, or you're a guy that like I tell you from South Dakota, I can't tell you how many times in corporate world that people underestimated me.
But there's an assumption with that.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Because you know, the other thing I was going to ask you is you know, with that assumption, I didn't read it, so correct me if I'm wrong, but do you have a master's like an MBA, right?
No. Oh, heck no. I never.
No, exactly.
Yeah, I never finished college, officially finished college.
So that's to me always the stereotype, right? So you walk into a room. Probably one of the first questions when you're early in your career is, where did you go? Do you have an MBA?
Yeah, I've hired more MBAs than you probably know, and I'm talking about Harvard MBAs. You know, I've had numerous of them on my staff and working for me, and you know, but I went to the School of Hard Knocks, and they didn't, and that's where I got my MBA, and I will put that up against a model anytime.
So that's what I was going to say, though. So do you value an MBA then?
Absolutely. But I also value someone who's done it all their life and know where the turnoff valve is for the one hose that's going to put out the fire. Yeah, I value that guy because he's the janitor. He's the person who knows where the hell that is. And the guy with the MBA just says, hey, there should be one here. You know, OK, well, that guy knows where it's at. So,
all right. So I need to be respectful of your time, Jeffrey. So I want to quickly do my fast five. It's five quick questions. You know, every podcast has these now. So five quick random questions, answer them as slow or as fast as you like. And then I just want to spend a quick 5 minutes talking about C-suite, what that's about, what direction you see that going. So are you ready to do fast five?
Go, put it on me, man.
All right. This will be very easy for you. First job ever.
Selling or delivering flyers door to door for my local trailer park that we lived in, which was King Arthur Estates in Warner Robins, Georgia. I got paid $7 to deliver flyers for the property management team, where my mom was a bookkeeper for. And what was the guy's name? I'm trying to remember his name. But the guy that was the manager of that, I remember. Oh, I wish I knew his guy. I can't remember. I'll remember in a minute.
All right. Question two. What animal best describes your management style?
Probably a bear. I like to think of buffalo, like a bison buffalo, because they're big and powerful and they're, you know, kind of solid and lonely. And it's cross between a buffalo, American bison, and a bear. Bear, I like to hibernate a lot, but I'm grumpy and I'm big and I like to get stuff done and I'm efficient. So I like that.
Are you like a introvert extrovert? Like you need your alone time?
Yeah. I got to have a cave time, man. And my wife, luckily enough, she really respects that and really helps me with that.
My wife's the same.
Yeah, I need that.
Yeah. It was like last week I was super stressed and she's just like, go golf, like get out of here. You're an asshole right now. Just go and do your thing and come back happy.
You gotta meet her. I like her already.
Yeah, no, she's good. She's military, so you'd get along with her already.
Was she Air Force or Army?
Or Navy? Sorry, I rephrase. Her dad was military.
What?
She was Notre Dame.
Yeah, oh.
He was Air Force.
Air Force, okay.
And then she has a brother. And then she has a brother who went to the Air Force Academy and another brother with the Naval Academy and then two brothers that went to Notre Dame with her.
Wow.
So
cool.
Yeah. Again, clearly not a stupid family whatsoever. So, all right. Question three. I don't know how you're gonna answer this. What advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
Faster, and quit listening to everybody else.
How do you mean faster though? Because I feel like your career has been pretty.
Yeah, solid, but it could have been faster. Could have been bigger. Could have done it with bigger zeros. I had realization. I thought I couldn't do certain things. I used to have these little voices. You know, we all have them. That tell you that you can't do this or you can't do that. Look, you're from South Dakota. Look, you're the biggest businesses in this state. Well, I figured out, well, geez, I can go do this in Iowa. I can go do this somewhere else. And so I stopped inviting those voices to dinner a long time ago. I just wish I had stopped doing it earlier. You know, think about it. I mean, look, I'm a poor kid. You know, some would even maybe call it white trash to some extent. You know, or trailer park trash or whatever you might think. I mean, I've actually had people say that to me, but which, you know, so I'm proud of that. But my point is, you know, there's a lot of people, a lot more money, a lot more things, a lot more opportunity. And I used to think that you needed those things. And you don't. And so it took me a long time to realize, no, I'm just as good as these guys are. I'm just as smart as these guys are. In fact, I'm smarter. I'm brighter. I'm quicker. I'm faster. And that's what I mean by being faster. I wish I'd have come to that realization quicker.
Well, I think what's interesting is at least on the surface, and please tell me if I'm wrong, your three books kind of emphasize that.
Yeah, no, without question. It's like, yeah, because my books are as much about business as they are self-help and how you to live this life, live the life that you want the way you want to, because you can and you should. And by the way, it's called hard work because it's freaking hard. So, just go do it.
All right. Question four. when you are dead and you're pushing up daisies, what do you want people to say at your funeral when they're walking around?
Just that he was a good guy. You know, that I really, truly, he was my friend, good guy. You know, I want my children to say he was a good father. I want my grandkids to say he's a good grandfather. And I want my wife to say he was the best man. So that's all. That's all I really care about.
Awesome.
And with my friends and family, that's really, truly, you know, what other people say outside of that. Look, I've been five business Hall of Fames. I've been inducted into Speaking Hall of Fame, Business Marketing Hall of Fame, Sales Hall of Fame, Printing Hall of Fame, Direct Marketing Hall of Fame. And look, yeah, those are nice. But, you know, being the Dad Hall of Fame or Best Friend Hall of Fame, man, that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Question five. So I have four questions that are static. Those are the first four. Question five is always kind of on the fly listening to you. So this is my on the fly question. Shit, I just totally forgot. This is why it's on the fly. damn it. All right, question five is...
Come back to it. I'll talk to you about the C-suite, then come back to it.
Well, no, I got to conclude the segment. So, all right, question five, I'm going to make it this one. Out of all of your jobs, everything you've done, which one has been the most rewarding for you?
I don't know. I haven't done it yet. That's my answer.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't.
Fair enough.
I mean, yeah, do I take away something from every single job? Without question. Every one of them has led to something much bigger and better in either in me or outside of me and to the things that I cherish the most. They've taken away some things too, but there's always a yin and yang with everything. But you know, did like my Kodak, did that give me the opportunity to get huge, huge, huge things? Absolutely. But the next thing is going to lead to the bigger, better breakthrough for whatever that is. And so to me, when people ask me, what's the best thing you've ever done or the, you know, biggest job or whatever, I don't know. I haven't done it yet. Cause I think something bigger. If you live life thinking that my best days are behind me, than they are. And my best days are ahead of me.
Because are you in your late 50s?
I'm 56, yeah. 56.
Okay. Because I'm always interested about the age thing. At what point do you say, okay, pump the brakes, let's just enjoy life.
Enjoy life.
Maybe this is how you enjoy life.
I enjoy life. What are you kidding me? I go to bed every night, you know, hoping I'll hurry up and sleep so I get going the next day.
I like it. All right. Well, thank you. And what I want to do then the rest of this time I briefly have you is let's talk about C-suite because, you know, I'm honored to be on C-suite for myself. I feel like I add some sort of value somewhere along the way. But where did this concept come from?
You know, with the C-suite, I just wanted to start bringing together the most trusted thought leaders and trust to the most trusted, executive network there is. So one is in terms of the C-suite network, you know, I'm tired of LinkedIn. I'm tired of all these places where people can just come at me and not go through a certain kind of protocol, not do their homework. And the best way to do that is just by putting up a few barriers by saying, look, I know that when I'm with other C-suite executives, it's like an unwritten rule. We know each other, we get each other. And so the conversations are deeper, quicker, meaner, and more meaningful, not meaner, but meaningful to me than when I just talk.
Probably sometimes meaner.
Yeah, sometimes meaner. But there's not so much chit chat. There's not so much of this crap we don't really care about. You know, how's the weather? Like, I could care less what the weather is. The weather's not good. I'm sitting inside. I got a freaking air conditioner. I got a heater. What the hell do I give a shit what the weather's like inside? Yeah. I'm working. I don't care. You know, so. You know, whatever it might be, or let's have coffee. Don't have coffee, dude. Just what the hell do you want? You want to do some business? Let's talk about some business. So, but when I'm at the C-suite level, it's those kinds of, it's more in depth and it's quicker. So what we want to do is create a red velvet rope around the community and create the most trusted community for these executives. And therefore I want the greatest content. And so I'm out recruiting people like yourself and others to create the best content and then curate that content and then serve it up on a silver platter to these executives so that they can continue to be the most strategic people in the room because that's their job. It's not to be the smartest, but to be the most strategic person in the room because that's the responsibility. That's the accountability they hold for the companies that they serve. And so that's really what the C-suite is about, is to create the community for these C-suite executives at a certain size, meaning 5 million or greater, being a VP or higher, all the way through billion-dollar companies. And today we have over 500,000 executives who are part of that. And then we're influencing millions of more executives who want to be a part of it or will be a part of it. And then to have people like you creating the greatest content and to be the most trusted advisors to that trusted network, well, that's a pretty daggone good thing. And that's what we're doing.
And it seems like you have a pretty succinct strategy of what you're trying to accomplish. I mean, between the TV, the books, the podcasting network, and then you also have an advisory board or advisory component of this as well.
Yep, C-suite advisors, you know, because then everybody says, well, Jeff, who's the best person to talk to about change management? Who's the best person to have come in and coach our team about you know, about customer service? And so well, we needed friends. We needed people like that. So what we did was we went out and identified those people, either from people we knew or recommended from C-suite leaders. So that's how we're getting these folks. So C-suite leaders are going, hey, you need to know Shep Hyken. Hey, you need to know, you know, this person, this person, this person. And that's how we're getting them.
And so this started around 2015. How is it? Is it met your
expectations? Better than we hoped.
And
but at the same time, we need to do more. We need more fuel on the fire. And we grew at 280% last year. We expect to grow at a greater clip this year. You know, just good news after good news. But we need to do more because there's so much more yet to get done.
So, you know, from a content perspective, is there a point where there's just
then they'll turn it off.
Providing too much content?
They'll turn it off.
Broad?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, as long as there's someone who needs it and they're consuming it, then we want to grade it, and we want to curate it, we want to develop it, and we want to be able to provide it. So, you know, when you need it and where you need it and how you need it. I mean, look, C-suite executives are used to having, it's like going to a restaurant that you're well known at. And you walk in, you sit down, and the first thing they do is they put the drink that you like to drink. So for my case, it's Glenfiddich Scotch, neat. And they sit it down in front of me as soon as I walk in. There's bars in certain places around the world. When I walk in or restaurants, they know exactly what I'm going to have. And they make sure I have it. Well, that's what the C-suite needs when it comes to information and business tools and resources. And that's what we intend to do.
Because, you know, just for me, I can only speak specifically about the podcasting network, you know, because that's what I'm on. Yeah. And I look at it, I think, how do you curate the content that doesn't directly overlap, you know, to where it becomes redundant? And at some point, it's become too redundant for the audience where some of them just lag because it's redundant. Or are you, and I'm just kind of a long-winded question, or is your theory is the best content always rises to the top.
So it's not just about the content itself. It's the manner in which it's delivered. So yours might be a little bit more laid back style. Someone else might have a much more rigid style and shorter, but yet it's the same content. It's just delivered in a different way. Or they like you because you're funny and the other guy because he's dry. So, you know, whatever it might be, you have to be able to serve it. And that's what we intend to do. And let the competition, let the market sort itself out. I'm very much a believer in that.
Well, listen, Jeffrey, to say thank you 1,000 times over isn't enough. But I have to end with one final question. It's the final question I ask everybody before you run. How do you define happiness?
Well, for me, it's around what I call conditions of satisfaction. And so I have conditions of satisfaction of what's important for me. And I measure them across four kind of areas for me. And I do a lot of thinking about this because I think it's important. It's around my business. It's around my family. It's around my friends. And it's around my spirit, my spirituality. And those are the four kind of cornerstones for me. And then what are my conditions of satisfaction in each of those? And they're not the same way, you know. And so that's how I kind of measure my happiness. But my biggest happiness is if my wife's happy, I'm happy. So and because she's the end of, I mean, look, she does stuff that all the time where I'm like, God, why didn't I think of that? You know? About taking care of people and being caring and so forth. And so she, you know, that's one of the biggest things. As long as she's happy, man, I'm happy. Because if she ain't happy, I'm not happy.
Well, My saying
exactly.
Happy wife, happy
every
life.
Guy knows that. Every guy knows that's the way it should be. I mean, you know, yeah. Like I want to take care of her, and by God, she takes care of me. And it's a very traditional and non-traditional relationship that she and I have in that regard, which is just it's just wonderful. It's wonderful to have.
Well, listen, thank you for your time, your energy, and your willingness to stop by Executive
After Hours. This was fun. So I want to do this again.